You are listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment, a podcast brought to you by Migrants Organise. Throughout this series, we hope to shine a light on the realities of the UK's immigration and asylum system, explore the pressure and anguish it puts upon people who go through it, while also hearing about hopeful and powerful acts of migrant and community organising. Each episode will focus on a different aspect of the UK's asylum system. On today's episode, we're joined by Yessa, a trustee from the Refugee Buddy Project, and a refugee herself. As we explore the journeys people make to come to the UK, the heartbreak of leaving home, and the barriers they face building a new life, we learn that the journey is not just a physical one, but an emotional, psychological, and political struggle, especially as the media seeks to dehumanise people who are risking everything. The Refugee Buddy Project started out in 2017 as a community group to welcome people who had recently arrived in Hastings and the surrounding area who were seeking refuge and safety. They are now a registered charity supporting 25 families through buddying, advocacy and financial and emotional support. Hi Yessa, thanks so much for speaking to us. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
That's good to hear. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and where you're calling in from?
I live in Hastings. I'm a refugee from Iraq, born and bred in Basra. And we moved to England many years ago. I lived in London for a long time, went to university in London. I've always had this passion for working with refugees, given my own refugee background. So I ended up with time working in the Buddy Refugee Project. And I am now one of the trustees in the Refugee Buddy Project.
So Yessa, as you mentioned, you started off in Iraq and then you came to the UK. Would you be able to tell us a bit about what that was like?
So I came home from school one day and my mother said we were going on holiday. And that was it. We left that evening. It was quite a surprise to be leaving Iraq. And we left through the borders of Iraq, Iran, lived on the borders for a few weeks. And then from that point, we moved to a camp to Iran, where we stayed there for a year, where we sought asylum. And after a year, we were granted to enter the UK. We left Iraq in 1994 and we arrived in the UK in January 1996. So it took us just under 2 years.
How old were you when you moved?
So when we left Iraq, I was 8 years old. Right. And when we came to England, I was just under 10. I remember my mum saying you could take one item with you, pick one item that you want to take. And it's very distressing as a child because you've just come home from school and you've got your routine and it's the weekend's coming up. And for mum to say we're going on holiday, I'm like, well, I haven't been told we were going on holiday and why can't I take my stuff with me? Mm. And, you know, so it was quite a big shock for us. We arrived in January as well, which was cold and dark.
Yeah.
We come from this sunny, warm country where I just remember spending my childhood barefooted running around in the warmth and surrounded by family and friends, spoke a language I knew and a culture I knew. So to suddenly arrive in West London in January where it's cold, you don't speak the language, you can't get the food you like. The vegetables taste different and we're eating cornflakes for breakfast.
Yeah,
it's very bizarre.
Why did your parents want to move to the UK?
So things were getting very difficult in Iraq. As a child, I mean, I remember some wars breaking out, but it's a very different perspective for a child. Quite right, the question you were asking, why did my parents want to move out? My dad was a university lecturer. So anyone of recognised qualifications, like if you're a teacher, a doctor, you got asked to witness what would happen if you went against the regime, Saddam Hussein's regime. And so my dad was not very comfortable with this, and they were being asked to maybe take part in things that he didn't want to. When you live under a regime, it's not, you can't really say no sometimes. And if you do say no, you put your family at risk.
Yeah.
And just in general, you know, unsettled, difficult life. And so they decided to leave. We had asked to leave several times, and we weren't allowed to leave the country. So therefore, we had to leave illegally. Hence, we were going on holiday. And I wasn't told about leaving because I was eight, and I might have gone and walked around telling everyone. My parents picked the UK because my dad got invited to do a PhD at Warwick University back in the 70s. So mum and dad moved to Warwick, and they lived in England for 10 years where they had my brother and sister. And so my brother and sister were British citizens. So my dad thought the best choice is to go to England, as we have two British citizens, where my dad started the asylum process. I think initially England said, send the two British citizens and the rest of you go back. So my dad was really mortified at this point. And it was actually, it was around the time in Iran where we were living in a camp. And I remember in Iran, you were allowed up to a year in this camp, and it was approaching a year for us. So my dad had written back to England and said, no, take all of us or we all go back. And going back to Iraq would have been the end of us, really, because you're not allowed back in. You know, you'd probably get shot at the borders or something. Yeah, so then they wrote back and said, okay, fine, you can all come in. So that's why my parents picked England, just because of the link.
So when the UK were saying, just send your brother and sister, how old would your brother and sister have been?
My sister would have been 18 and my brother would have been 17.
Wow, so still very young, really.
Yes. And it was, and I remember when that decision came through very well, when they said you can send the two children and the rest of you go back, because we were in a camp in Iran, and I remember seeing a coach turn up and a load of, I believe they were Afghani refugees. They just got forced onto this coach to be sent back because they'd been there for a year. Like, I mean, families, children, just kicking and screaming, being forced on this coach and being sent off. And my dad was absolutely mortified. I recognized fear as a child in my dad's eyes. That was the first point where I thought, right, I'm actually quite scared now. You know, seeing fear in parents.
When you got the chance to move to the UK, how did you actually travel here?
The initial journey was all a bit, there was no plan for it. You know, we got in the back of a van from our home in Basra in Iraq. From the back of the van, we were driven to the borders of Iran-Iraq. And when we got there, we effectively had a people smuggler that got us out of the van, put us on a horse carriage. And we, so this horse carriage took us through a bit of rough marshland. Then there was a canoe. I remember a canoe being appearing out of somewhere. To that, it was us and two other families squashed on this quite slim canoe, and the man who was the people smuggler was maneuvering it through the marshland because the water was quite deep. None of us knew how to swim, and then we had to walk at night and hide in the day in the marshland because there were troops everywhere, so you don't want to be spotted. There were young children. I even remember one of the families had to just make sure that her son was asleep in the daytime because, you know, how do you control a toddler? You know, it's so that was quite challenging. I was very confused because my mother had told me we were going on holiday. And I left, and then halfway, it was in the marshland where I was quite thirsty and hungry, and I just had a paddy. I just said, if you don't tell me what's going on, where we're going, I'm going to scream.
Right.
You know, I can see everyone else is like keeping quiet. The game was to keep quiet, and I played that game till I actually, I'm quite thirsty and I'm cold and I'm hungry. And I don't understand why you, my parents, that are supposed to be caring for me, are putting me through this, and you're calling it a holiday. And that's when Mum said, well, we're going to England. And I thought, no. I want to go home. I want my granny. I want my friends. And I remember thinking to her, well, if we're going to England, I didn't even say bye to anyone. I didn't understand, because to me, home was lovely and it was warm and I had all my family and friends, and you're just putting me through this process to leave this really lovely place in my eyes. So it was very confusing. And I think it ingrained a bit of quite marked distrust in people from my respect. I felt like I'd been lied to by my parents to go through this thing. And I think that kind of stuck with me for quite a while. I just didn't trust people. It leaves long-term scars, things like that. And I don't like being thirsty. I still don't like being thirsty because I've been really thirsty before. We got to the side of the borders where it was safe, where there were tents where we could stay and where the Red Cross and the UN would come and supply aid. And quite a few of us got quite sick there, because even though the water was clean, it wasn't very clean. Well, you know, it was very limited aid. They might not come for weeks, and then they do turn up. And it was there that my dad actually asked there was no process for seeking refuge there. It was just dad happened to ask someone that was providing aid, if you would help us, if you can bring us some form, in the hope that this person would deliver these forms and some kind of process would start. Someone came back and said, yep, we're going to take your family, take you to a camp in Iran.
Yeah.
And that's when we just sat in the camp in Iran while England processed some paperwork. Mm-hmm. But from that point in Iran, from when they decided, yes, you can come over to the UK, we got driven to an airport in a nice car and put in an airplane and flew over and arrived in Heathrow Airport in an airplane. There was quite a rough part to leaving. And then quite a civilized way of getting on an airplane and coming here. But it all felt quite surreal.
Thank you so much for sharing your journey. It sounds like a horrible experience to go through at any age. So you spend a year in a camp and then you get this plane to the UK. And one of the things that's very interesting about how you tell the story is that as soon as there's an official way to do it, as soon as you have permission, it gets a lot easier and a lot more humane. And while you don't have permission when you're leaving Iraq, that's where the danger was. Do you think that that's an okay way to summarise what you've just said?
Yep. Yeah, that's quite a good sum up there. It was literally, it's like, I remember even as an 8-year-old thinking, how come now we just get on a nice car and we get on an airplane and we get flown over? But the last year I've been treated like that.
It's
like you get labeled, you're illegal, you've lost your rights, now you're legal, or you have rights, you can be treated like a person. And I've definitely, even as an 8-year-old, picked up on that.
But let's talk about you arriving in the UK. So you're about 10 now, and you're in this grey, cold country, and it's January, and January is very rubbish. What did you think of the UK? How did you find it?
Well, it takes a very, very long time to settle in. The settling process, I think initially you're just so overwhelmed by everything that's there, you know, we quite often as a family relate, I don't know if you've seen the film, The Terminal, or Castaway, where Tom Hanks is just stuck on this island, and suddenly, you know, you come into this land where there's electricity, there's water, there's people, there's, you know, now I've been out of school for a year, I'm going to a classroom and sitting there with other students. It's quite overwhelming. It's very overwhelming. And not speaking the language. And suddenly you just feel very isolated and alone. And it takes a long time to settle into this new life that you found yourself in.
It's very hard to imagine what it's like to move to a totally new country and not even speak the language and be expected to go to school. And I suppose you know, moving schools at the best of times is a very stressful experience for a sort of young person and a teenager. And it must have just been, you know, an extra layer of just totally overwhelming for you coming to a new country and not necessarily speaking English as well as the other children might have.
Yeah. So where we landed in West London, Hounslow, and then we got moved to Hayes, Uxbridge area, there wasn't really a support group for refugees resettling, or there wasn't one that we knew of at the time. Mm. This was in 96. And we did find it very difficult. And, you know, I've got, it's family, I've got three other siblings, and the age groups, you know, there's 18, 17, a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old. So it's quite varied age groups. And you see that we all handled it very differently. And I think, you know, being displaced as a child is hard. Being displaced as a teenager, as my elder siblings were, was extremely distressing for them. Hmm. And being displaced as a parent, suddenly you're in this new town, you haven't got a penny spare, you've got four children to feed. You're, you know, my dad, who was a university lecturer in Iraq, who had done three PhDs, he'd done one PhD at Warwick University, is now having to do PGCE training before he could work. And, you know, and that would take years. So it was very distressing. You don't just come into a country, you know, refugees are very driven to grab onto opportunities, but there's obstacles like language and retraining. And those years are very hard because you, it's very frustrating. It's a very slow build-up of your new life. And financially, you don't, it's very tight financially. And I remember mum had to do all the housework and cooking for us and go to work. So she used to wake up at 6 a.m, make us dinner, then make us breakfast, then leave to work. Then we get home, dinner, she'd already made us dinner, we eat dinner, and then she comes home and does. So it's very difficult to adapt to. Only recently I found out there was a refugee support group in that area, started in 1998. But it was very hard to, you know, we didn't know about this. And this is a prime example of even when there are support groups, they were only just starting out in 98. And I think that coincided with things getting quite difficult, more hostile in 98. So I think the community's response was to try to be more supportive of refugees. It's very difficult. It's very mentally draining. And I think we all as a family spent the next 10 years wanting to go home. And yeah. I say 10 years because we weren't allowed back in Iraq until Saddam's regime was broken, but you're just forever mourning home, really, and we still do. I don't think you ever get completely settle into a new country. You make a new home, but home is always home.
I was going to ask, was there a point where it got easier, where you felt like maybe you were a bit more comfortable? Or from what you've just said, it sounds like it never entirely became comfortable.
No, I got stuck every, you know, I used to cry about it. you know, every year I used to just cry to my mum saying, like, I want to go home. You know, I miss my family. I miss my relatives. You know, it's just not nice here. I don't understand why we've come here. It's very hard as a child because you don't see what your parents saw was bad back home. So it's very confusing. And I think, yeah, so I spent, it wasn't until I was, it wasn't until 2004, I think it was, we went back to Iraq to visit. So many, many years on, we went back to Iraq to visit, and it was not the home I remembered it to be. It was all bombed. My family had changed, you know, because just the stress they'd been living for. And it suddenly, I could see why my parents wanted us to leave. I could see that actually what they did, what's happened to me, that I've, you know, that the place I craved, the home I was mourning, was no longer there. And that was closure for me. As sad as it is that it's no longer there, it was closure for me that actually I need to move on and just make a new life where I am in England.
So, yes, yeah, so you talked a little bit about finding it very hard to trust people again. I wondered if you could elaborate on that.
Well, I think the way we left Iraq, where, you know, I wasn't sat down and talked to about how we were going to leave and why we were going to leave. And I think quite rightly, my parents probably thought she would not understand, and I wouldn't have understood. So there was no choice but to tell me that we were going on holiday. Yet that's my whole life gone, as I know. So that's quite a big letdown for anyone, really. You know, so I kind of felt a bit distrusting of my parents from that point onwards, especially the journey that we followed through was really quite traumatic and mentally stressful at times, you know, for an 8-year-old to go thirsty and hungry. And my parents were, this was my parents' doing. So I just grew into this adult that I just didn't trust people, really. I just, why should I? You know, the people closest to me have lied to me. And as a result, I'd lost my life as I knew it. And so I remember going to university and seeing people in relationships. And I just remember thinking, I don't understand what you're doing. I don't understand how you're able to do that. Just let someone get so close to you. And I didn't do relationship right into probably my late 20s. And when I did do relationships, I was a little bit of a nightmare. As in, if anyone got too close, I'd run away. You know, that was the end. I was not comfortable of attachment, I suppose. And it's only because I just thought, well, anyone could let you down. My parents, I felt let down by my parents. I just felt, you know, if someone does something to you and it's quite hurtful, and it's only many years later, having gone through working with refugees and seeing the same pattern repeat now with other families and how it impacts the relationships between the parents and the children, that I understand, you know, now I understand what happened there, and I'm able to move on from the way I feel towards people and how I've labeled things in my head. But it's a very difficult scenario, because, you know, I was, when you have experiences as a child, your brain is still developing and you're growing with these mindsets. So even as an adult, yes, I've recognized my pattern and I understand why. It's very difficult to just stop doing behaviors that you've learned from childhood. And I think as a refugee, there's many things, like I have a fear of running out of water because I went really thirsty once. And even now I'm in my home, I'm speaking to you and I have a bottle of water right next to me so that I don't go thirsty. Do you see the impacts of the mental health impacts of these little things you experience are very difficult to shift, even if you recognize them as an adult. And I can sit here and talk to you about them. And I'm still unable to shift these learned behaviors from traumas.
I can see from what you've said how that would have a real lasting impact. I was very interested in what you said about how your work with other refugees and asylum seekers has helped you reflect back on your own experiences. Is there anything else you've learned, you know, from other refugees and asylum seekers which has helped you?
To be honest, when I went, I always, in my head, I always thought I must work with refugees because there must be one or two things that I can tell someone that I've experienced that might help them. Just things that I wish people had told me at the time. And then I went in not really knowing what I was going to get out of this, not expecting to get anything out of it. I went in to sort of share my experience. But my goodness, it's been one large therapeutic session. You know, I've never had therapy for my displacement. None of my family have had therapy. You know, with the trauma we went through, the displacement, you know, and I think working with the families, like, for example, the parents, this is true probably for most of the families that I've worked with. And it was certainly true for my family. Now, the story I've told you of how we left Iraq, imagine being that parent. I've given you the child's perspective. Now, as a parent, you've nearly lost your kids in your home. Then you try to leave to seek somewhere safer. And in that process, you've made them thirsty. You've made them hungry. You've smuggled them out. You've put them at risk of death, really, the whole family. And then you get to safety and you just cannot let your kids go because you're so fearful that actually something might happen to them. You know, the trauma of how you leave, it just makes quite overprotective parents. And that was definitely true for my parents, because when we came to England, I remember like wanting to go to the park or just going out. We spent loads of time being outside in Iraq. And my dad would just be like, no, no, it's not safe. You don't speak the language. We don't know what it's like here. Right. And, you know, many years later, I see it with the families now. In fact, we have quite a few volunteers that when the families first arrive, they go to visit the families and the kids are sitting in the window looking out. And they, you know, and it's sort of like it's because you don't know this new world. There's a fear as a parent. You've been through a lot of trauma and you're worried about your children. And so that seeing that in other families made me realize my parents weren't just being overprotective for no reason. This is a repetitive pattern that happens. These parents are traumatized and they're scared of anything happening to their children. So that's another example, but there's so many different aspects that I'm sure if I'd sat down with a therapist, if we'd had some form of family therapy, it would have addressed why dad won't let us out or why my brother's acting up like he is, you know.
Yeah.
And you see these repeated patterns with the families here in Hastings many years later. It's sort of like the impact, mental health impact of displacement on parents, children, and how they behave. And I think seeing that repeated in other families has made me understand what we went through as a family.
There's something that I think this is a very powerful example of solidarity, not charity, but really like that it's a two-way street, isn't it? Working with people, it's not just about you helping them, it's about them helping you. And I think that's a really powerful example of that.
Absolutely. I think I've gotten more out of it than I put in. You just can't appreciate the value of this two-way relationship.
Have you been able to talk to your parents about what happened?
Yeah, we do talk about it. We have a few films that we have watched that we relate to. I actually watched one recently with my mum, and in the process of watching it, it always brings up, because we relate to these films. And again, you know, I go to Castaway, which is one of our favorite family films, and it's because you're isolated. It's that feeling of isolation, and you don't know where anything is, and then suddenly you come back to this world, and in some ways it brings you really close together as a family, because you've been through a trauma, you've been through a trauma together, and you were all there to support each other. And yeah, we do talk about it, but I think the mental health aspects of, like, the impact it's had on us, there are still definitely ongoing issues within the family, that it's just a long-term effect, you know, of the outcome of the mental health strain. So I think even today we would probably do with a family therapy session. This is the long-lasting effects of it.
Sure. That's hardly surprising, but it's very interesting to hear about how films and media and art is sort of a way for you to experience, you know, those things together. I think we won't go into that further today, but that's a really interesting example. So, yes, sir, thanks so much for sharing your story. I think it's just incredibly powerful and brilliant that you're able to be here and talk about it with us. I wondered, as you work with a lot of other people who've been through the asylum system and had to leave their countries, would you say that your experience was typical, or would you say that, you know, people who are asylum seekers now have different experiences?
I think the struggles definitely not shifted from the ways people are seeking refuge. In Hastings, you know, we have had crossings, migrants crossings and landing on the beach. And I actually happened to be on the beach one day where a boat was rescued by the RNLI with 32 people on it. And it was almost at that point where it was on a day off, and I'd gone down for a sea swim, and there were these migrants. And it immediately took me back to that point where we'd been through those, you know, that journey of leaving Iraq, crossing the marshes. And when we got to the bank of safety where there's tents and food aid, and it was almost this fear of, are you going to let us in? Mm. Are you going to let us in? Because we've just had this horrific journey. And I just remember thinking, I looked at these people on the RNLI and I thought, I know exactly how you're feeling. I know what fear you have in you. And the thing is, everyone else that hasn't been through that journey may not realize what you've just been through. In that respect, yes, the struggles are definitely still there. And if anything, there's more struggles, because it's a more hostile environment these days.
And like in your case, like, people who are doing it are desperate to leave, aren't they? They're not doing it by choice, as you've been saying. Often leaving home is heartbreaking. We do hear a lot in the press quite horrible things about asylum seekers, and this kind of image of an onslaught of asylum seekers. We hear about the migrant crisis. You know, what do you make of all of that reporting?
It's made in a way to just channel the anger at the refugees rather than actually looking at what is the core problem here. This is very personal to me because I come from Iraq, from Basra. You know, we went to war with Iraq and destroyed that country. And we don't hear anything about what Iraq is like now. So it's, you know, people say, oh, these people come here for better education, for better medicine, for better living. No, you know, their countries have been destroyed. We have a liability to home these people.
I just wanted to bring up another thing which we talked about before the show, which was about, you know, in your community engagement, as a way of helping people to put themselves in the shoes of asylum seekers, you would ask people a question, like, if you were a refugee, what help would you want? What responses did you get to that question?
Quite often the responses I got, even with people that I worked with, quite often I get the response of, oh no, it wouldn't happen here. It's sort of this, they've disengaged it in their brain that this happens to them, this happens to these people, and it couldn't happen to us, which I think this is where maybe COVID has shaken people up and made them feel like, look at how fragile we are, look at how fragile our world is. And actually COVID mimicked a lot of sort of displacement, you know, the fear of not being able to go to the shops, you know, it's quite similar to what displacement refugees experience and how stressful life can be. And it's quite interesting that the answer to that question is that, you know, if you were a refugee, what would you want? The initial response is, well, I'm not a refugee. I wouldn't be a refugee. But it's like, actually, it could happen to any of us. And then the conversation changes, you know, it changes. And they'd say, yeah, well, you know, yeah, it is very difficult for them and they should be supported.
So you are a trustee for the Refugee Buddy Project. And you've talked a bit about working with other refugees and asylum seekers before. Could you tell us a bit about the Refugee Buddy Project?
So I started out as a volunteer. As I said earlier, I've always had this passion to work with refugees based on my personal experience. I came across a few refugee families with that had come to Hastings from Syria. And that's how I actually found out about the project, is through families that I met through my work. So I started as a volunteer in the project in 2018, and the project had only just started then. And it rapidly grew as more and more families were arriving in Hastings. And initially in the project, we weren't sure how many volunteers we were going to get on, if we were going to get enough support. But I think we quite quickly, within a year, had more volunteers than refugees. And so the project grew and it has become a registered charity now. It's led by what the refugees' needs are. So we initially started when we started taking Syrian families through the Vulnerable Persons Resettlement Programme. And so we've taken 30 families. Our main aim of the project was to give the newly arriving families a warm welcoming into Hastings and just help them resettle and make a friendship so that they don't feel lonely and isolated when they first arrive. And then more recently, we've started taking, with the new scheme for their Afghan citizens, that with families that have, I believe they have been flown over and they've been in hotels for some time. We do help quite a few people who are seeking asylum. So we help a lot of people with no recourse to public funds. And these are people who seek asylum that are given £35 a week to live off.
Yeah, and we will have a whole episode looking at no recourse to public funds and the actual support which is available for people who are applying for leave to remain. So as we were talking before the show, you mentioned how the community has responded to people arriving by boat, but also refugees and asylum seekers being resettled to Hastings. I wondered if you could talk a bit more about the community response.
The community response, it has been amazing in Hastings. You know, as I said, when the project first started, we weren't sure if we were going to get any volunteers. And we immediately had more volunteers than refugees. So we actually have a few volunteers per family. You know, we've had to share them out. The incident that I was there, people off the beach were coming over saying, can we get them anything? Can we get them chips? Can we get them drinks? It's a very warm, welcoming community here. And I hope that that's that's the attitude that's reflected elsewhere across the country, because I think the media tries and shifts it in a negative way. But I think people are educating themselves and aware that, you know, these refugees welcomed in.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the specific challenges and needs of people who are newly settled.
As I said, we started off as just doing house preps before the families arrive, and then we show them where the local shop is, where the coffee shop is. They get allocated buddies, so they get help with their English conversation. Further on from that, we were coming into problems with lots of the families, and each time we came across a problem, we got together, we discussed it, and we acted on it. And one of the first problems we had was I witnessed this at the hospital, and the families were feeding it back to the project, is that there was no interpretation service at the hospital. So due to cuts in funds, and I was witnessing things where consent was not appropriate because the language barriers, hospital appointments were being cancelled because of language barriers, and this was breaching equality and diversity. So we decided to act on that and wrote a report which is called Lost in Translation, and it looked at the experience, the need for interpretation services and access to NHS for refugee women in Hastings. And as part of that, the conclusion was that the hospital accepted that they needed to employ a new interpretation service. And we got these iPads and we're still using them. And so that was a really lovely positive outcome. We did a similar thing with, we've recently released an education report where we found families were having difficulties. The children were having difficulties accessing extra English support and extra, you know, meeting educational needs. So we recently did a report into the education and experience of refugee families. Part of the report is that flagging up a problem, but also more importantly, bringing in a solution. And our most recent work that we've only just started doing is on mental health support, because we've seen there's a major lacking mental health support for refugees, obviously being through the trauma, the displacement, even people with known health conditions that aren't really getting the support once they come here. So we've only just started working on that, and we're hoping to build something, yet again, another report to show what difficulties we're having, where the mental health support's lacking, and how can this be achieved, to try and build a module where we try and support refugees with their mental health needs.
Well, I think that that's all the questions that I've got. Thanks so much for coming on the show for this first episode. I think it's been so fantastic hearing about your story and also the work the Refugee Buddy Project is doing. We'd love to have you back on the show a little bit later on.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And I feel honoured to be sharing my story. And I think if we don't speak out and share our own experiences just to make other people aware of why people are displaced, why they move on, what mental health impact is involved and what challenges are faced. And I think, I hope that people hear me here and take on board, you know, that it's not by choice, it's challenging, and just be supportive of refugees and give them a warm welcome.
You have been listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment. Today's show was brought to you by Migrants Organise, a platform for refugees and migrants to organise for power, dignity and justice to enable meaningful inclusion and integration. They combine advice and support for individuals affected by the hostile environment immigration policy with community organising, advocacy, research and campaigning to dismantle structural racism. The theme song for this episode is Conform or Be Cast Out by Of Moy Om.